Today on Mr. Media, I'll talk to Eric Wallace, who's a writer and executive story editor for the sci-fi original series Eureka. He's also writer of the upcoming DC comic book title, Mr. Terrific. Stick around, but folks, if this guy starts messing with the time-space continuum, I'm afraid we're going to have to evacuate the show. So much media, so little time. Who keeps track of it all? That would be me. This is Bob Andelman, and this is a Mr. Media interview. You know, MrMedia.com, MrMedia.com. Stop by and check it out. There are more than 900 archives, celebrity, and pop culture interviews for your listening pleasure. The show is brought to you today by Audible. Audible is offering Mr. Media listeners a free audiobook download and a 14-day trial offer to give you a chance to check out their very cool service. I love listening to books on tape. If you've never tried it before, actors or sometimes the authors themselves read to you. It's great for the commute, the beach, or even unwinding before bed. You can choose a free audiobook from Audible's enormous library of sci-fi and fantasy titles, including Where's My Jetpack by Daniel H. Wilson, The Greatest Science Fiction Stories of the 20th Century, and The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, written by Michael Chabon. Here's an excerpt from The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, read by David Colacci.
In a Zharkov's laboratory on the kitchen table, he had invented almost functional button reattachers, tandem bottle openers, and heatless clothes irons. In more recent years, Sammy's commercial attention had been arrested by the field of professional illustration. The great commercial illustrators and cartoonists, Rockwell, Leyendecker, Raymond, Caniff, were at their zenith, and there was a general impression abroad that, at the drawing board, a man could not only make a good living, but alter the very texture and tone of the national mood. In Sammy's closet were stacked dozens of pads of coarse newsprint, filled with horses, Indians, football heroes, sentient apes, fawkers, nymphs, moon rockets, buckaroos, saracens, tropic jungles, grizzlies, studies of the folds in women's clothing, the dents in men's hats, the lights in human irises, clouds in the western sky. His grasp of perspective was tenuous, his knowledge of human anatomy dubious, his line off.
You could also download Will Eisner's Spirited Life, which I wrote and will read to you personally. To download your free audiobook today, go to audibletrial.com/radio. Again, that's audibletrial.com/radio. For your free audiobook. Mr. Media is recorded live before a studio audience that exists in a timeline that closely parallels your own in the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. I would have written this introduction hours ago and had plenty of time to polish it, except, as usual, my wife and daughter insisted I drop everything and watch the latest episode of the sci-fi original series Eureka. Not that it's ever a tough sell with me. Eureka is, after all, one of the smartest and most entertaining shows on TV. And I know this cable's sweet spot doesn't attract the same word of mouth that shows on the networks or on HBO does, but trust me, it's worth your time. Now, on previous shows, I've had the pleasure of chatting with several stars of Eureka, including Colin Ferguson, Niall Mader, and Neil Grayston. But today, us fans of the show get an extra dimension. A behind-the-scenes peek with writer and executive story editor Eric Wallace. That's him waving. Wallace joined the show in Season 1 as an assistant before joining the writing staff full-time. Now he's one of the most visible faces of the show's writing room, and his work is featured on the upcoming August 8th episode. And when he's not writing for Eureka, Wallace has a second gig as a comic book writer. He's behind Mr. Terrific, one of the titles DC Comics is launching as a first issue this fall on September 14th. Eric Wallace, welcome to Mr. Media.
Thank you. Good to see you, sir.
Good to see you. Glad to have you here.
Thank you.
Yeah, we've talked about this off air, so you know that Eureka is very special to my family and myself. We're very devoted to it. Haven't missed an episode. My daughter's seen every episode over and over and over again. The thing I wondered, though, broadcasting is season 4.5. You're already working on season
Yeah. Right? So 4.5 is
4.5.
On the air, right?
Yeah. And you're working on season 5. What I wonder is, when a show gets to be around this long, does the cast and the crew still see it as special, or has it become, you know, the grind, the job? It's what you do every day.
Well, I think that's a great question, and I'll tell you, usually when you get to a fourth, fifth, hopefully a sixth season, it does become a grind. It does become kind of, well, it's a great job, don't get us wrong, but it is a job, and you know what you're going to do today, and especially perhaps if you're working on a more procedural kind of traditional, say, a cop show or a lawyer show, and don't get me wrong, I actually love those shows, but it can get kind of to that case of the week, and it's very familiar, and the characters perhaps become a little stagnant. Well, I think we were very much aware of that on Eureka, and going into our fourth season, we didn't want to have that kind of sedentary kind of attitude around the set and then the stories, because we love what we do, and we want it to be exciting for us, because we think that'll translate to you, so we decided to do something a little crazy, and that enabled us to come up with the time-traveling storyline going back to 1947 at the beginning of season 4.0, which really, I think, still continues to bear fruit story-wise now. And that has re-energized everyone, from the cast to the crew to the writing staff, the folks at the network. Everyone is just so excited about where we are right now, because we feel, and we hope the audience feels, that we're telling our best stories right now in season 4, 4.5, 5.0, and hopefully beyond. Mm-hmm.
It does seem like you got to go back and do Eureka 2.0, in that you're able to change characters, maybe that you felt wanted to do something different with, but still make it kind of natural and organic to them. You know, people like Fargo getting to run GD when the show started. I mean, Neil Grayston had said to me, which I kind of suspected, that in the first season of the show, he was basically there for a couple episodes. He was not intended to be an ongoing character.
That's correct. But he popped so much in the stories with the audience, with us as the writers and producers of the show watching dailies. We were just amazed by his ability to craft comedy in a performance, but also some poignancy and some real drama. And you really had sympathy for this character in what he was going through, especially in those early Stark years where he was getting kind of dumped upon a little bit, let's
Fargo.
Say. Fargo. Exactly. And it's funny, I was talking to Sally Richardson Whitfield, who plays Allison on our show, and we were talking about how this kind of all came about, the 1947 thing, and she kind of summed it up when she started to talk about what it was like when we first told her what was going to happen in season 4.0. And she said to me, she said, you know, Eric, when I heard what you guys were doing with Fargo alone, because I think Jamie Paglia, our co-creator and the showrunner of the show, and Bruce Miller, our executive producer, and also the co-showrunner of the show, they had told her Fargo's the head of Global Dynamics. That alone, Sally said, something different and something very special is going on. Wow, where do we go from here? And it excited her. And I think a lot of people had that reaction.
Well, and I mean, she had a great change. She came back to the future and found that her son could talk, was no longer autistic, and it was just like, what in the, you know?
And what that gave us was, we have a fantastic new actor, a young man named Trevor Jackson, who is playing the new Kevin. He's a teenager now, and Kevin's a brilliant a mind still. But now we're seeing another side of him, which I hope you'll see a little bit more of in season 4.5 and 5.0, because Trevor, the actor, is a brilliant singer. He was on Broadway in The Lion King, for example, and he's got I think he's kind of the next Michael Jackson, personally. I mean, he's that talented. So in 4.5 and 5.0 and beyond, we're going to be finding ways to really incorporate that young man's talents in a very exciting way. And now the scenes between Allison as a mom, mm-hmm. and the Kevin character as a son, not that they weren't dynamic before, but it was a different kind of a take. It was more of her as protector solely. Right. Now the son can talk back because he's a rebellious teenager, and we're going to see more of that in upcoming episodes. And so it's exciting to see Trevor and Sally in scenes together.
Well, now I'd like to welcome back my daughter, Rachel, who has some questions of her own for Mr. Wallace.
Rachel. Sounds good.
All right. Let's get Rachel in.
Hello.
Hello. So, I hear you have some questions for me.
Yeah.
Fire away.
Have you always wanted to be a writer?
No. Actually, no. I grew up wanting to be a musician, actually, and had no idea that this would be my path. And what's funny is if you ask my friends or other people who knew me growing up, they would tell you differently. For example, I love horror movies, and I remember co-writing my first horror screenplay at the age of 12. We all went to go see Dawn of the Dead, and we're very inspired and decided, hey, we can make a zombie movie too. We did the same thing again after Halloween, and I remember writing from about 12 to 14 several screenplays on school notebook paper, but not really thinking about it in any sense. That was just, movies were something that somebody else did, and TV writing was something, it was something that was put on a pedestal. I never really thought that much about it, and my friends were kind of like, you know, you might want to do more of that, and I'm like, no, I'm just going to play my guitar and be a musician. But I guess in college, one of my best friends finally sat me down and maybe had an intervention and said, you know, you should probably really pursue this. You keep having this interest in films and television, and you seem to be able to just whip out a script like it's nothing. You know, you might want to follow up on that. So I took his advice and changed from a biology med, pre-med, to film. And I've been there ever since.
Well, what kind of music did you like when you were growing up?
Well, it's funny. I like rock and roll and jazz and fusion, where they meet. So I'm a big progressive rock nut, Rush and Yes and Emerson, Lake and Palmer and Genesis and Pink Floyd and all of those bands that my older sister had grown up with. She had all the records. I was, you know, very young at the time, but I remember she was into Yes and into Rick Wakeman, of all people. And I can remember stealing her Rick Wakeman Journey to the Center of the Earth record at 8 or 9. Otherwise, I would have never known who Yes was. And taking it into my room and playing it and listening to the story that this kind of music, progressive rock music, they're known for telling stories. So that's kind of how I got into it. They were so crazy, and the stories were sci-fi in nature and fantasy-oriented. And I think that's what drew me into that kind of music. And then from that, I got into jazz, and I became a big Miles Davis nut, and Mingus and Thelonious Monk. And then that led to Chick Corea and Mahavishnu Orchestra, and I've been there ever since.
As a writer for Eureka, do you write for any specific character?
No, we all tend to write for all the characters on the show. I will confess, I do love writing for Neil's character, Fargo, and writing for Joe, Erica Chera's character. I really, especially if I can get the two of them in the same scene, there's something special. I love writing, not that I don't like writing for Colin and Sally, and actually I love writing for Sally too, especially I love to write more humorous scenes for Sally. We don't get to do that too often, especially if you're watching the current season 4.5 of Eureka. You know that Allison's in a bit of deep water right now. It's very intense what's kind of going on. No spoilers here, but that's been very exciting. So I do like writing those three characters a whole lot, and also writing Larry because he's funny.
It's weird having like Larry be like a slave sort of for Fargo now. Different. Fargo. Fargo and Claudia had a crossover in, I think, season 4. Is there going to be another crossover during this season or the next?
That, it's hard to say. We did cross over Neil because our schedules for Warehouse 13 and Eureka didn't quite match this year. So we did manage to get Fargo over to Warehouse 13 this season, or is that next season? No, the season you're watching now. So that would be season 3 of Warehouse 13 has a crossover episode. So you'll see Neil and Claudia reunited, and their situation will continue. Unfortunately, we didn't get the Claudia character over to our show this season for 4.5. But we love her. We love Allison. She's fantastic. It's great chemistry. So I would say it's a pretty good chance that her character will return to the town of Eureka sometime in the near future.
I guess my dad wants to come back to the spotlight. Thank you.
You're welcome, and thank you for watching the show. We really appreciate it.
Oh, it's no problem at all.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
What was your first... wait a minute. Thank you, Rachel. Thanks for some good questions, and Eric for good answers. Eric, what was your first significant contribution as a writer to Eureka in terms of storyline?
There's two answers to that. One would be when I was an assistant in season one, I actually wrote and produced the webisodes. That was kind of my first exposure, and it was running kind of parallel to the stories in season one. So it's very interesting if you watch they're on the season one DVD box set. And if you watch them, there's a point in the episode, what's the season one episode? It's called Blink, where a guy is running really fast and he hits a tree. And it's towards the beginning of the show, and Taggart shows up with his headgear and whatnot, and he mentions that he's been looking for Bigfoot in that episode. That webisode series spins off from that moment. It's going on at the same time as the Blink episode is. So if you know that and you watch the hide-and-seek webisodes, you can kind of see that we kind of planted the seeds in that particular episode. Funny story about that episode, by the way, I digress, is that was originally supposed to be aired as episode 3. We ended up airing the pilot as one, then Many Happy Returns, of course, is the second episode with Susan Perkins and Is She a Clone? And She Arrives. And then we ended up having a really fantastic episode called Before I Forget, which was written by John Rogers, who's now the showrunner of Leverage. And it was so great, we decided to move it up to the third spot. But if you're watching the season one DVD very carefully and you watch the order of the shows, you'll notice that Zoe's already in high school at that point. But when Blink airs, I think it was aired 8th or 9th or 7th or something like that, it's her first day at Cafe Diem. It's her first day at school. It's her first boy that she meets. It's very funny. That's because, yes, that was originally supposed to be aired in the three slots. So a little trivia for you there. So that was my first exposure.
You know, there's actually an odd, I guess, growing tradition of that sort of thing happening. If you watched Firefly, or people who are fans of Firefly, and we didn't know this because we didn't watch it when it was on the air. We picked up on it later on DVD. The episodes aired out of order on Firefly in its original network run, and then when you get the DVD, they tell you how they're supposed to run, and it's still confusing. But to watch it, I guess the powers that be at Fox at the time felt that, I don't know, episode 3 or episode 4 was a stronger way to introduce the series. But then once you saw that, it didn't make sense to go to the next, you know, to have to go back to the first episode. Anyway.
Well, it's tricky. It's tricky. With our show, we had a much simpler mythology, so it didn't really matter that much. I think we all kind of agreed, hey, the more viewers we can get on the show, the better. So if we have a strong episode, yeah, well, let's move it up. It wasn't a problem. It's more an amusing anecdote for us now. I know Firefly fans, I watch Firefly too, are a little bit more, how should we say, hot-tempered about the topic.
Yeah.
And I feel for them. I feel for them. We were very lucky in that sense that it ended up working out really great for us. But that was my first exposure. But the proper first exposure as a writer and working in the storylines really didn't start to come until season two. Season two, I started out as an assistant, and then about two-thirds of the way, they had promoted me up to staff writer. So beginning with that season two, we had such a small staff, and it was such a family atmosphere where everyone could collaborate and could contribute and whatnot. So when I wasn't taking notes and getting coffee, the things that you're supposed to do as a writer's assistant, which I make a very good cup of coffee, by the way, still do.
I'll have to try that sometime.
I was able to begin at that point to kind of start contributing some ideas and whatnot. I had contributed a couple of ideas in season one, but I mean, just little things, you know, not significant at all, really. Although one scene, I will say, I think it was my suggestion to put a cat fight in Purple Haze. I don't know if that's good or bad. It might be a bad suggestion. But we did get Beverly Barlow versus Allison in there, so I was very proud.
That was great.
That my one suggestion.
No, that was great.
Kind of snuck in there. But I started to just, like anybody, just have a lot of time in the room working and listening, because when you're a young writer, you just want to learn your craft. You don't want to just jump in there and start spewing things, and that can be a little dangerous. But by two-thirds of the way, when they promoted me to staff writer, I was able to get my first episode. That was God is in the Details, which was towards the end of season two, which was a really great learning experience for me. It was my first episode of produced television, so I learned quite a lot there.
You know, I was just thinking, you mentioned Beverly Barlow, who plays kind of the bad guy when the show starts, and is back now and again playing the bad guy. In between her leaving the show or being off the show and then returning, there really wasn't a malevolent force on the show. Everyone was pretty much good and good-hearted. Bad things seemed to happen, you know, because of the technology. But now Beverly is back. There is that sort of malevolence going on beneath the surface. And we learned at the end of last night's episode that Allison is being completely controlled by her. So
right.
Fascinating twist and a return to some of that stuff from the beginning of the series.
Well, there are really two things going on from the writing staff's perspective on that. One is with season 3.0, with the Eva Thorne character specifically, there was a conscious effort by the writers and producers to say, all right, we had a villain in seasons 1 and 2 who is overtly a villain. Let's try and have a villain in season 3.0 that is sympathetic, that has a good agenda. Eva Thorne's idea was she wanted to come back and see if her brother was still alive underneath in that bunker and was still immortal. Turns out, no spoilers. Sorry if I just spoiled the ending of season 3.0. I feel bad. It ends well, but there is some sadness and some poignancy there. But there was a deliberate attempt to create an antagonist that was sympathetic to the audience. Mm-hmm. And I thought it worked pretty well. I think we all agree. There were some really special moments, I thought, with Eva Thorne that we had never seen on the show in growing our world and showing that kind of a character going through that kind of a struggle. It was she's dealing with immortality, and is she immortal, and how long will she live, and what are the implications of the purple goo and that you see in the little vial at the end of 301, Badge of the Drone. So that was definitely a unique situation and an experiment that we tried that we felt worked pretty well. Having said that, I know Jamie, and again, I don't want to speak for him, but I have heard him say many times, wow, you know, we never really got to tell the entire Beverly Barlow story. This was season 3.0 and season 3.5. I wish we could get back to that somehow, but these things have to happen organically. When you're in the writer's room, you don't want to force things. You want to pitch an idea, discuss it, see where it goes, find the best interpretation of that idea, and then run with it. Well, when we went back to 1947 and we said, this is really great, now they're back and this is the origins of the consortium, and you know, and Grant's here and he's played wonderfully by James Callis, where could that possibly lead us? And the obvious answer to us in the writer's room was, oh wow, I think we just stumbled on a way to bring Beverly Barlow back. And immediately this electricity went throughout the writer's room where we all just were like high-fiving each other. We can do this. We can bring her back. This is great. And now we see her in 4.5, and I wish you guys could know where we're at.
Just tell me. No one's listening. Just right here. Just tell me.
At the end of season 4.5, the thing happens. No, seriously, though, but what we're building towards in the end of season 4.5 will really, I think, blow some minds. It's pretty phenomenal, and we're all so proud of it. We're glad that there seems to be a great response to 4.5, but Beverly Barlow has never had a bigger plan. It's never been wilder, and especially with the episode that I've co-written with Jamie, our co-creator, that airs August 8th, Omega Girls. Everything changes with that episode. It's a pretty exciting thing, and we get some action in there, and it's directed by Sally. It's her first time as a director, and she just knocked it out of the park. I mean, she's a born director. She has the gift. It was incredible to see. You're really going to like what she's done.
Anything else you can tell us about that episode?
Well, without giving some spoilers away, I didn't watch last night's episode. You know how they have next week on Eureka? Did they show any special guest stars returning or not?
Gosh. I am not prepared to answer that question.
That's okay. I will say this about Omega Girls. I'll say several things. One, yes, Beverly Barlow's plan is going to be exposed, which is very exciting. Mm-hmm. And we have the return of a special guest star from Eureka's past, who I think folks will really enjoy seeing. And you've never quite seen this character in this light. As I mentioned earlier, Sally, what she did so wonderfully in directing this episode was there was a lot of action and there's a lot of visual cues. I don't want to give it away. How do I say this? There's a lot of camera kind of tricks and gadgetry that go on that's very complex and very complicated. And she got out her director's notebook, did her studying, and I think brought a whole new level to this kind of episode, because it's kind of a run-and-gun action episode, and it's something that we've only hinted at on Eureka, and we just decided to go full Monty with it this time, and the results are, I think, pretty exciting. Pretty suspenseful. It's a very suspenseful episode.
Now, I'm just thinking back to what I remember seeing last night. Sheriff Carter's daughter returns in this episode, I think.
Ah, okay, good.
Is that who you were talking about? Return? Okay.
Yes, right. I wasn't sure if they had revealed that in the next week on Eureka, but yeah, Zoe's back.
Zoe, I'm sorry, yeah.
And what's great is Zoe's back, and as we know, she has a crush on Zane, but Zane's going out with Joe. Will all of that stuff hit the proverbial fan? The answer is yes.
Ah.
We will, let's just say we're going to get some resolution to that particular storyline in a very interesting way as Zoe and our residents of Eureka are thrown into a situation that the town has never encountered before. This is full-scale, almost war going on. Again, without revealing too much, but it's highly action-oriented. It's almost like in the writer's room we discussed in this episode, if we could make Die Hard and we could put our town in the middle of it, what would that look like and what would the sci-fi twist be? Now, we didn't have $80 million.
Yeah.
We didn't have anywhere close to that. So it's the small version. It's our TV version of that kind of a storyline. But it's pretty exciting.
But, Eric, you guys have done phenomenal things with a cable TV budget, not just not even a network budget, but a cable TV budget. I'm thinking two things come to mind, well, actually three. One is Tiny, the robot that attacked the guys when they were camping. I thought that was incredible effects, knowing the kind of budget that you guys must be under. And so that was one in the first episode of season 4.5, sending Fargo and Zane up into space. And then and by the way, I noticed in last night's episode there was a return of the International Space Station, which I thought you guys must have paid a lot for that prop the first time. And probably just wanted to get some more use out of it, or maybe it's all CGI, I don't know. And
amortizing
then,
your cost.
Yeah, well, yeah, right? And then in last night's episode, and I know it's CG, but the floating bank was great. I mean, what you get out of your effects budget and your people is phenomenal.
Thank you. I'll tell you, we have the best effects guys, visual effects guys in the business. That's Matt Gore. He's our visual effects supervisor, and he is so dedicated to going above and beyond what we ask him to do. And Matt has been with the show since day one. I believe he has been here since the beginning of season one, and all of the wonderful things you see, we tell him, hey, there's this story where Carter is looking for a bank, and it's floating, and his Jeep goes into outer space, and we know that's crazy. Well, after he stops laughing, he says, all right, let's do it. And we're like, can we afford that? And he's like, let's make it happen. And he has this incredible passion. And Tiny, I'm glad you mentioned that. That's his baby, him and his team, Matt's team. They spent so much extra time and extra effort going beyond the call of duty to make it something very, very special. And I think I'm glad you reacted to the results in such a positive manner because, yeah, sometimes there were times where it was good enough for us, but the effect wasn't good enough for Matt. And that's what makes a special visual effects, I think, guy. And he or gal, we have some gals on our team, too, who are wonderful. And I think that's what makes them do such a great job. They're just phenomenal.
Just a couple more short things about Eureka, then we'll take a break and we'll come back and we'll talk about Mr. Terrific, your DC great. Comic coming up. I want to come back to this whole switch with the space-time, the time travel. There had to be the temptation when that first developed to bring them back to their regular timeline. And just as easily as you could write to send them back to 1947, you could write and have them come back to the right timeline, or at any point get them, you know, through a dimensional rift or whatever. You know, I'm sure we've both read enough Fantastic Four comics. We know there are dimensions lurking behind every door. But you guys chose not to do that. That was the surprise, I think. Was it a tougher decision not to send them back to where they started, or to you know?
Right, right. And again, that was a conscious decision. Mm-hmm. That was very much an idea to say, all right, we're going to make a bold choice and revamp things and take things in this new kind of different direction. And we like what we're doing and we believe in it and we feel strongly about it. Let's stick with it. And now there was a very long debate for several weeks there. Are the audience going to accept this? Are people going to think they're going back at any moment? They probably will. How do we reassure them in a sense that this is the real universe and we're staying here and we're never going back? And we figured the best way to do that was to just not comment, was to just do it. And that's exactly what ended up happening. And to Sci-Fi's credit, our network and our studio guys and gals said, yes, that's the right choice. You know what? If we're going to do this, we're behind you 100%. Just go forth and never go back. And interestingly enough, it's the same thing that kind of discussion we had when we were killing Stark back in season 3. The idea was, okay, the actor is, you know, leaving the show to move on, and we know in advance, we have him for 4 episodes, we're building towards his death, and the 5th episode's kind of a coda. Well, do we kill him in such a way that says, oh no, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, he'll be back, you know, at the end of the season? Or do we really give him a powerful send-off that says, no, he's not coming back, and as unfortunate as it is, death is a part of life, and that's reality, and we decided, no, that's the way to go. Let's show a little reality here. And we made that decision, and I think that ended up, again, being one of our best episodes, where you realize the sacrifice that Stark made, and he's not coming back, even though we got his ghost back last season. That was very fun to see the actor again. But, you know, he's not lurking somewhere in another dimension. Of course, never say never. We love Ed Quinn so much. I'm sure if we really worked hard, we could probably find a way to bring him back because we love him so much. And never say never. Obviously, I've heard Jamie say that many times with many characters. But, you know, right now, Stark is dead. Right now, the universe that we're in is the universe, and we will never go back.
Right now?
Yeah, with the universe thing, I don't think we'll ever go back.
Okay.
I think that's a permanent.
All right. I had to ask you that because it came up with Niall and with Neil, and they both said, we're pretty sure we're not going back, but we're not positive, and we don't want to be the ones to go on the record and say we're not going back. So I have one more. I could go on talking to you about Eureka forever because I love the show so much, but I have one last question, and this is from my wife, Mimi, who is in love with Grant. She would like to know, is James Callis, will he return either in season 4.5 or in 5, or is he out of the picture for good?
Again, going back to what Jamie says about characters, it's a never-say-never situation. Are there immediate plans? No. We love James Callis. I would love to see him in every episode. I think he's phenomenal. I've been a fan of his you know, from Battlestar Galactica and things before that. So no, there are no immediate plans, but you never know. You never know. I say stay tuned. That's a question I don't really have an answer for either. That's a question that only Jamie and Bruce, our showrunners, can really answer.
And Eric, I'm sorry, I lied. I have one more question. It just occurred to me, and I've brought this up with the actors on the show a couple of times, and actors for this other show. I don't understand. Sci-fi is owned by NBC. NBC has one show that, to me, fits into the world of Eureka and Warehouse 13 like nothing else, and that's Chuck.
I knew you were going to say that.
Chuck is wrapping up. It's in its last fifth and last season. Eureka is in production. They're in production. Why have we not had a crossover with Chuck? It's the same audience that, you know, that people would love. People would go nuts to see, you know, The Intercept being fixed by the people at Eureka.
You know, we love Chuck, too. I've been watching Chuck since day one. I personally am a big fan of the show, and they're nice folks, and, you know, and I love the cast, and I love the crew, and I love the writers and everything. They're great people. You know, it's one of those things. It's probably never going to happen. I won't say that it is absolutely out of the question, but that's tricky because even though we are owned by the same family, they are kind of different networks, USA and Sci-Fi and NBC and whatnot, and they're kind of already closing the door on the Chuck story, and, you know, we don't want to step on their toes in any way and kind of, you know, mess things up by Eureka-fying things, but it would be nice, I admit that. As a fan of both shows, I would love to see it. I'll bring it up in the writer's room. I have a feeling that one's kind of going to get thrown out.
All right, you'll bring it up for me, though.
I will.
All right, because, you know, depending on how they end Chuck, if there's still an Intercept out there, once that series comes to an end, there's no reason that, whether it's Morgan or Chuck or someone else, that Intercept couldn't, you know, I mean, there's been nothing to... Well, anyway, all right, I'm done.
Maybe they'll send it to Warehouse 13.
Yeah. That would be great. And then, like, in 2 years, they could bring Chuck out of the Bronze Age or something, you know?
There you go.
All right, cool. All right, let's take a quick break. This is Bob Andelman, and you're listening to and hopefully watching the Mr. Media interview with executive story editor for Eureka on Sci-Fi, Eric Wallace, and we'll be right back. Folks, you can hear Mr. Media while on the go now with Stitcher Smart Radio. Stitcher is a free news and talk mobile app available for your smartphone, whether you use an iPhone, iPod Touch, Android, BlackBerry Curve, or Palm Pre. And when you download Stitcher to hear Mr. Media today, you have a chance to win some real money. Downloading is quick and easy. Just find Stitcher in your smartphone's app store. Download it, it's free, takes seconds. Then, during registration, hit the promo code box and enter Mr. Media, that's MR Media, to get automatically entered to win $100. The latest episode of Mr. Media will be waiting for you in Stitcher's favorites right on your phone. You'll get access to lots of other amazing shows, too, always available to you on demand, no syncing. Some of my favorites include WTF with Mark Maron, Plus One Per Diem with Kevin Smith, and The Nerdist with Chris Hardwick. It's all free and all instant to you on Stitcher Smart Radio. And don't forget to win the money. Enter promo code Mr. Media, MR Media, when you register. And thanks for listening.
Hey, this is comedian Bill Engvall. I know what you're thinking. You cannot be a blue-collar comic because you were on the show with Mr. Media.
This is Bob Andelman, and you're listening to and hopefully watching the Mr. Media interview with Sci-Fi's original series, Eureka, executive story editor, Eric Wallace, who also has this other job we're going to talk about now. He writes comic books. Eric, how did you get involved with comics?
Been reading comic books since I was 5, 6, 7 years old. It's a lifelong obsession. Mm-hmm. And I just got lucky, I think. I had been going to the San Diego Comic-Con, which is the annual convention, pop culture convention that they hold every year. And I'd been going for, I don't know, 10, 12, 13 years or so. And I remember one year I was on Eureka at this point. I ran into a friend of mine who was writing on Smallville. But he had also started out in comic books also. He'd been writing a lot of Superman and Batman and whatnot. And we struck up a conversation and I said, as exciting as it is working in television, I hope someday that I can also write big comic books. And my friend turned to me and said, well, that's my editor at DC Comics, so let me introduce you. And my mouth hit the floor. I went, wow. It ended up being Eddie Berganza, who is the senior editor over at DC Comics, who is just the most amazing person if you ever meet him. A champion for diversity, a walking encyclopedia of not just DC Comics knowledge, but comic knowledge in general. I mean, just a great, wonderful guy. So my buddy introduced me to Eddie, and I was in awe because I knew his name from reading comic books all these years. And I said, Mr. Berganza, I would love to write comics for you someday at DC. And he said, oh, that's great. You're working on Eureka. Give me your number, and we'll stay in touch, or email. So I did, and we stayed in touch, and it was another 2 years of me just kind of checking in every 3 or 4 months. Hi, how's it going? I'd really like to write comic books because it's a very small pool, and there has to be the right kind of slot, the right kind of book, the right kind of story. There also has to be opportunity and whatnot. But 2 years later, I had kind of almost forgotten about it at that point. I got a call, and it was Eddie saying, hey, you still want to write comic books? Yes. How fast are you? Very fast. All right. I need a story for the DC Halloween special. This was the 2008 special. And I need it tomorrow. It stars Vixen. It's 8 pages long. Go. And I went, I'll talk to you tomorrow before noon. Thank you, sir. Hung up. Panic. Sweat. I've never written a comic book story before. I don't know what I'm doing. I love Vixen, which is great. So I just came up with a story overnight that was about, I'm a parent, and I wanted to write a story that would be empowering for young black females. So Vixen is fighting Mirror Master, and there's a black family in this place where they're fighting, and the little girl looks at Vixen and at the end of the story and says something to the effect of, wow, you're so amazing, I can never be you when I grow up. And she turns to her and says, no, you can be anybody you want to be. And a cue weeping and all that stuff. I figured, oh, this is too cheesy. No one will even like this. I'll be laughed out of comic books. And I fooled them. They liked it. And literally a month later, I got another call. Hi, how's it going? It's Eddie. A little bit more relaxed call this time. So how would you like to write a 6-issue miniseries starring the Tattooed Man? It's coming out of Final Crisis. And if you do, can we get a pitch from you this weekend? Sure. Again, never having even written a full-length 22-page story at all. I'd only written the 1 8-page Vixen story. I said, sure, sounds good, no problem, I can do that. Hang up, cue sweating, cue panic, cue me going, oh, what have I done? Oh, I 6 issues, I've never even written one. And you just sit down after the panic and you just write your way through problems. That's how writers work. We say we can do it, then we sit down in front of the typewriter and the blank screen is staring at you and you go, I can't do this. I can't do this. And you have to write your way through the problem. And that's the exciting part. That's where whatever that magic is occurs. So I did that, and I haven't turned back since. They offered me a gig on Titans, which I've been writing now for 18 months. That ends this month. And then Mr. Terrific is the newest opportunity, and I can't tell you how excited I am about it and to be a part of this new 52 initiative.
Now, I want to ask you about Mr. Terrific, and I know you're dying to talk about it. I'm more peripheral to comics today than I was 10 or 15 years ago. I hadn't heard of this character until you brought it up in a previous conversation. So Mr. Terrific is an existing DC Universe character who's
yes.
getting his first shot at his own book. Is that right?
That is correct. Okay. Yeah, Mr. Terrific was a member of the Justice Society of America. That was kind of in the universe that exists now, but which will be changing in September with this new launch, the new 52, the reboot or whatever what people would like to refer to it as. But it's the core values of the character haven't changed. Mr. Terrific is still the third smartest man in the world.
I love that.
Now, of course, I get the question all the time, who is number one and two? And I know who one and two are. And it's a running kind of joke because there is a sense of – there's a little bit of humor in the new Mr. Terrific book where people come up to him all the time. They come up to Michael Holt when he's in his Mr. Terrific costume and they say, hey, you're number three. What's that like? Does it annoy you that there's a one and two out there? Who are one and two? And to me, that's such an absurd notion that it has to be acknowledged in the book. So we run with that. You'll learn who one, two, and four are, because I think four is also important over the course of probably the first year of stories.
Can I guess?
And sure. I have folks guessing all the time. Please, go ahead.
I'm going to go with, and I'm a little out of touch with the DC Universe, but I'm going to go with Lex Luthor and Hardware.
Okay. One of those is correct. One of those is not even in the top 10. Yes. No, I'll give them top 7.
All right, then I'm not
I'll give
far.
Them top
okay.
7.
All right.
And what's interesting about, and I won't tell you which one was right, but one of those was correct, and I think you can guess.
Yeah.
But we want to await to officially release it in, I think, around issues 8 through 12 or something like that of Mr. Terrific. What's interesting to me is everyone seems to be able to guess one of the top two, but they have no idea who number two is. And number two is actually going to turn out to be a very special person in Mr. Terrific's universe, and it's part of a major storyline that you'll be seeing over the course of year one of the story.
Well, if First Wave was continuing, I would have guessed Doc Savage.
See, that is a great guess. And who knows? You know, you may see at some point those characters kind of woven into this new universe, obviously not initially. I would put him definitely in a what, 6-5, somewhere in there? I mean, that...
Hard to imagine anybody smarter than Doc Savage.
Yeah. I think that's a great guess, personally. I think that's an outstanding guess. How can
Thank
I
you.
Get him...
Thank you very much.
It makes me, when I hear these kind of great suggestions, how can I get him and Mr. Terrific? You know, that. What would it be like if the two of them met? So, maybe I'll take up your offer. Do I have permission to use your suggestion in a DC comic book
with any legal
obligations to you?
No, none to me. I just, you know, deal with the Kenneth Robeson estate. I love Doc Savage.
Better make a phone call over there.
Yeah. I suspect DC still has some rights there that you can probably tap.
Yeah, sure.
Now, interestingly, as I've read about Mr. Terrific, what's available right now, seems to me that he's actually a bit of a cross between Doc Savage and Batman, or Bruce Wayne.
Yeah. In the sense that, and very close to Batman, in the sense that both of them are billionaires, both of them have their gadgets and whatnot. Mr. Terrific, oh my, what's this? Could this be a Mr. Terrific doll? As we see here, his little T-spheres. I don't know if you guys can see that.
Cool.
And this is his old costume. He has a new costume with the relaunch. But his T-spheres are his kind of gadgets that he uses in the same way that Batman uses batarangs and his bat belt and his bat boat and that stuff. The key difference, though, and this is, I think, a very important distinction, Bruce Wayne doesn't enjoy being a billionaire very much. He's brooding. He's dark. And when he goes out with models and whatnot, it's all an act to him. I'm so sorry. You're being forced to go out with models. This is so horrible. Jeez. Not Michael Holt, Mr. Terrific. He likes being a billionaire. He likes going out with models because he's normal, because that's fun. Who wouldn't? So there's a very, very large kind of separation between the two characters in how they approach being both heroes and how they approach their secret identities. And I think that's a pretty key difference between the two. And they're both super smart guys, obviously. I mean, yes, clearly Bruce Wayne has got to be in that, you know, top 10, maybe even top 5 kind of thing. But he's so overwhelmed by his responsibilities, by his need to avenge his parents' death. Michael isn't burdened by those things. Michael has a different burden, and it's an unusual one. What do you do when you're truly smarter than everyone else on the planet, except for these two people who you don't know who they are right now?
Right.
I mean, how do you even go to the grocery store? How do you interact? How do you even talk to people? You kind of have to prevent yourself from being arrogant. You kind of have to watch yourself, because everything everybody says, you could probably guess or predict, or you're ahead of them. The minute they ask a question, you're like a chess master. You're not 10 or 12 moves ahead. You're 22 moves ahead of everyone. And that means Michael is always in his head, which means his heart perhaps is being ignored. His heart, his emotions, his inner journey, which is a big component of the Mr. Terrific book, that what we see is he's not all together inside, and he needs folks around him who represent the heart to his head. So when I'm building the team of Mr. Terrific, I put together a great team of folks, and primarily diverse folks. There's a lot of African-Americans, Hispanic folks, gay folks, Asian-American folks, because I want the world of Mr. Terrific to reflect the world I live in, which is a diverse one. But he surrounded himself with folks who represent, I think, the heart that he lacks or that he needs or that perhaps has been broken. Mm-hmm. And that's what's going to try and help make him whole. But until that really happens, you're going to see him getting into so much trouble because he's following science. He's following cold logic. He's following his head all the time. And that's great when you're fighting supervillains, but it's not always best for your personal life.
Well, let me ask you, Eric, because you brought up the diversity issue, and it has been brought to my attention by our crack research staff that you are a black man, which I had not previously been aware of. And I actually read a couple of days ago there was some criticism online, or there's been some criticism that in the new 52 launch that women writers have been kind of gotten short shrift. Now, it sounds like in your book, all of the diversity is going to your book. That it's like it's all in that book. And I was going to ask you, even before you brought that up, that a lot of the names that I read in previews are very African-American sounding names. There's not a lot of Eric Wallace's in the Mr. Terrific universe. And I just wondered if you have any concerns in doing this launch in laying on too much diversity and too many names that sound not like Eric Wallace, I guess is what I'm saying.
No, it's a great question. And no, I don't. I have no concerns about that because I'm not approaching it that way. I'm not approaching it as I'm writing the black book. I'm just trying to write the best comic book I can, and I want to populate it with a world that I recognize in my daily life. That's literally how I look at it. As to the rest of the books, what I think folks maybe haven't pointed out is there's 52 new number ones that are coming out in September. Well, five or six of those spotlight diverse characters. It's not just my book alone. I kind of maybe wave the flag a little bit more, but perhaps because I am an African-American writer. But we have Batwing, written by Judd Winnick, I love his fantastic writing. And, you know, no, Judd is not an African-American writer. That's not the point. The point is he's a great writer, and he's writing what I think is going to be a very exciting African-American character. I can't wait. So you have Mr. Terrific, you have Batwing, you have John Stewart, the African-American Green Lantern, headlining Green Lantern Corps number one, along with Guy Gardner and Kilowog. That's three right there. We haven't even gotten to Static Shock yet. I mean, and I only wish Dwayne was still around, Dwayne McDuffie, the co-creator of Static Shock. I only wish he was still around to see this, because I think he would be very excited. But you have five or six books like this, which are a percentage of that 52, and that's a pretty good percentage. I don't know the math, obviously, whatever 6 of 52 is, but there's 10% or 11% black Americans here in America. That's about 12 to 15, 13, 15%, somewhere in there, you know, of the comic books that are being released. So for me, that's exciting, and that really does mean DC is putting its money where its mouth is. And again, with the women creators and female characters, I completely agree with that. DC, Dan DiDio, and Jim Lee, I believe, published a public response to that, I believe, yesterday or the day before on the blog, which I thought was very inspiring. It was, hey, fans, female fans, you called us out on this, and you're right. And you know what? We need to do better, and so we're going to do better. And they put out the hand of friendship, and they've made a commitment. And I think you're going to see direct change as a response to vocal female fans saying enough is enough. I've tried to put a lot of females into my book. Some of them are surprising ones I can't really talk about. But the second in command of not just Michael's company, Holt Industries, but the entire world that he's involved in is a strong, powerful black female named, of course, now I forgot her name. How ironic is that?
Yeah, well.
Alika, pardon me. It's Alika. Alika Okafor. And she's as big of a character in Mr. Terrific as Michael is. And in some ways, she may be the most important person in that book as far as saving Michael's emotional and moral life.
And by the way, does DC get credit for keeping John Jones, the green Martian Manhunter? Does he count in the diversity issue? I'm never really clear on that.
That's a very good question. I guess it depends on whether or not you believe in alien life. I believe in the possibility of alien life. So for me, yes, that, you know, a green guy, an alien, I don't want to be xenophobic. You know, if aliens do come to the Earth, I'd like to extend the hand of friendship and the olive branch. Maybe I wouldn't, but I'd like to think I could go there. You know, I don't want to be a xenophobe kind of guy. So yes, I do think that's important. But obviously, as far as what the diverse community is concerned with and asking for, clearly I don't think the green guy is quite as important, say, as a strong Asian American female character.
Okay. All right. We'll go with that. I would like to see Wendy Wu from is it Nickelodeon or is it Disney come back as a cartoon character.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, I'd just like to say if we're looking for a strong Asian character. Anyway, one more question about diversity, and I think we'll wrap up. We've tied you up quite a bit today. I didn't ask you about diversity on Eureka, and one of the things I think that's happened in the change with the time travel, a lot more African American characters. Grace is on there all the time. Trevor Jackson as Allison's
Kevin.
Son. So of course Henry and Allison.
Joe is Hispanic.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And you know, depending on which side of the fence you fall on, it's no secret that Vincent is probably gay. You know, I think we're kind of saying that in a subtle way, hopefully, and we're trying to get him a boyfriend on the show.
Are you really?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
I have to be honest, it never crossed my mind that he was gay.
Good. That means we're succeeding. You're just seeing him as a character and as a human being, but we know as the writers that he's a gay character. That's why we're trying to figure out who's a good boyfriend for him and what would be a great storyline for him. Hopefully if we are lucky enough, you know, to have further seasons down the line, that's one of the stories that we're very excited to tell.
Well, I know when I interviewed Neil Grayson a few weeks ago, he said that the character he'd like to have get the opportunity to break out as Fargo did would be
Vincent.
Thank you. I'm sorry. I just went
right,
completely blank.
Right.
So
yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. And to address your diversity kind of point, I'll tell you this. I'm so proud to be on our show for that very reason. You look at our show, Eureka, and say Grey's Anatomy, which are shows that are speaking to the mainstream. In their case, in Grey's Anatomy's case, it's the mainstream, real mainstream. In our case, it's mainstream science fiction, family-oriented and whatnot. But we have these incredibly mixed, diverse cast. In Eureka, the smartest man in town is African-American. We say it many times, and no one bats an eye. No one says, oh, well, the smartest African-American man in town is Henry. No, the smartest guy in town is a black guy. I'm just proud to be a part of that. And that's something we talk about all the time, is how can we, again, diversify the world to reflect the country and the world and the planet that we live in. It's important.
Well, I was just thinking, I noticed this a week or two ago, Warehouse 13 introduced a new character this season, Jinx, who they went about 3 weeks and then they announced that he was gay. And it was like, oh, okay, so there's the diversity. And, of course, the most powerful person on that show is an African-American woman,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And
it's exciting.
Yeah.
It's very exciting. And obviously, we all know that sometimes sci-fi and fantasy lead the way in kind of showing diverse situations. I mean, going all the way back to Uhura kissing Kirk in Star Trek. I mean, this is not something new.
Right.
Captain Sisko on Deep Space Nine, one of my all-time favorite shows, and a show that spoke to me very specifically because it was an African-American father talking to an African-American son. And now I think the next step is to, more than just putting diverse characters in front of the camera or on the page, in the center of the page, it should be about diversifying the world around them, or if it's on the page, behind them.
Mm-hmm.
So that even if there is a Caucasian character in the scene or in the movie or on the comic book page, you look behind them in the panel or in, you know, the background of Kathy Guillen, and you see diversity celebrated around them. That's the next kind of crucial steps that I think we need to take in our pop culture media.
So maybe in the background of Cafe Diem leading up to Vincent coming out officially, maybe we'll start seeing like a couple of guys or a couple of women making out in one of the booths or something. And with no comment by anybody. It's just
with no comment, yes. Well, we are a G-rated family show. We do have to, holding hands perhaps.
Oh, okay.
You know, two guys or two young ladies holding hands, I think would be probably a little, we'll work up to a kiss.
All right. Well, I mean, you guys did have that romance didn't go very far between Andy and Sarah. I mean, that was, you know, that was unforeseen. That was a little diverse there. You had, the robots.
And stay tuned. You never know. There might be a little more to that story. Who knows? I'm just saying.
Just saying. Not that you would know.
Not that I would know.
No, not that you would know.
I'm just saying.
Just saying. All right. Well, folks, listen. You can enjoy writer Eric Wallace's work in two distinct mediums. First, he's a writer and executive story editor for the sci-fi original series Eureka, which airs every Monday night this summer at 8 p.m., and you can follow his adventures there as well. The Eureka writers have their own website, and I don't have it in front of me. Do you know it off the top of your head?
It's Eureka Unscripted. That's is it. The name of our writer's blog. I don't have the exact full address, but just Google or go to your favorite web browser and just punch in Eureka Unscripted. It'll pop right up.
And it's great because there's blog entries. You do some. Other people do them. There's photos from behind the scenes. Very cool. And they also they tweet frequently. So you can see that. And just as summer ends and Eureka wraps up its summer season, you can watch for the launch of Eric's new DC comic, Mr. Terrific. It will be in comic shops on September 14th as part of the new DC 52. Do you want to give folks your Twitter? Or
Yes, you can follow me, Eric Wallace, at Erote. That's my Twitter handle, Erote. So hop on board, and I'm always talking about new artwork or what it's like, the writing process on both Mr. Terrific or behind-the-scenes stuff here at the writer's office on Eureka. So follow me, and it should be fun. We hopefully get to learn a few things about the inside nature of Hollywood.
Well, it's been very – and, Eric, it's been very cool talking to you today. You've been very patient. We've kept you a long time. Thank you so much for joining us on Mr. Media today.
No worries. Thank you so much, and have a great rest of the day. Thanks, everybody.
Bye.
Hey, everybody. This is Kevin.com Brown from the Emmy Award-winning 30 Rock, and you know what? I wish I had 30 rocks to throw at Mr. Media's ass. Yeah!
Hey folks, you can hear Mr. Media while on the go now with Stitcher Smart Radio. Stitcher is a free news and talk mobile app available for your smartphone, whether you use an iPhone, iPod Touch, Android, BlackBerry Curve, or Palm Pre. And when you download Stitcher to hear Mr. Media today, you have a chance to win some real money. Downloading is quick and easy. Just find Stitcher in your smartphone's app store. Download it, it's free, takes seconds. Then, during registration, hit the promo code box and enter Mr. Media, that's MR Media, to get automatically entered to win $100. The latest episode of Mr. Media will be waiting for you in Stitcher's favorites right on your phone. You'll get access to lots of other amazing shows, too, always available to you on demand, no syncing. Some of my favorites include WTF with Mark Maron, Plus One Per Diem with Kevin Smith, and The Nerdist with Chris Hardwick. It's all free and all instant to you on Stitcher Smart Radio. And don't forget to win the money. Enter promo code MrMedia, MRMedia, when you register. And thanks for listening.